Welcome back to another episode of Drivers, Sports and Leisure Research Group's podcast devoted to bringing you the latest trends in the golf industry and the innovators leading them. I am David Klein, along with John Last. And for today's episode, I know our listeners will be able to think back early in their careers when they met people who really made a big difference in their career trajectory, really made a big impression on them, and really inspired them to bring their best game to the table. John, I know that today's guest is someone who played that role for you in the early days of your career in the golf industry. Who do we have joining us today on the first tee? And tell us a bit about your history together.
Thanks, David. That's absolutely right. It's kind of hard to believe that when I was in Orlando in January for the PGA Merchandise Show, it was the 31st time that I'd actually been there. I kind of like to kid around that I was 6 years old at the time when I started attending the show. And if only that were true.
Well, but your birthday is probably February 29th then.
No, it's not. You know, it's not. But, you know, for all sakes and purposes, I could have been 6 years old because my shows, first shows were right after I got out of school. And I was a young staffer for the PGA of America, and my responsibilities included marketing and strategy around the show's development. And there was so much to learn. And our guest today is somebody who probably didn't realize it at the time, but really impressed me and quite candidly intimidated me a little bit from day one. Because he had a dual role of being not only a top executive at a number of the leading brands in golf, but also was the chairman of the association that represented all the show exhibitors. And it was pretty common for him to come in and really kind of speak on behalf of the whole industry to us, made a huge impression on me, has made an indelible mark on the golf business. He's a past recipient of the Ernie Sabarak Award from the PGA, which awards lifetime achievement in the game. And he clued me in that he's actually attended 56 shows. So thankfully, he's got me by a few. I'm honored to have Jim Vincent with us here on Drivers. And Jim, love to get started by really kind of helping our listeners get a brief history of your career and some of the many highlights that you've had.
Yeah, thanks, John. The one word I think that really applies to career is luck. I was born into a golf family. My dad had played in the first Masters. And ended up being a sales representative in the Southeast. In fact, ironically, Ernie Sabarak hired his first employee from my dad, a gentleman named Johnny Berg. And then the luck continued while I was teaching school, wanting to get into the golf business. And I went down to the PGA show in 1968, which at that time was held at PGA National, which is now Ballin Isles, in old circus tents. And we knew they had been circus tents because the elephants were always close when it got to raining. It was a fragrant experience. So what happened is I had left a resume with Dunlop, which was a major player in 1968. And I tailored it a little bit since there wasn't much to my resume. And I listed the three players, Dal Finsterwall, Paul Hahn, and Ed Ferdahl. As references, because they all knew my dad, and I'd met them anyway. And as I went up into the clubhouse to have lunch, I ran into Paul Hahn. And Paul was a premier trick shot artist for decades in the golf industry worldwide. And I told him I hope he didn't mind, and I used him as a reference. And he got up from lunch, walked me down into the Dunlop booth, and said to the gentleman with whom I've been speaking, if this kid's half as good as his dad and you don't hire him, you're making a mistake. And the guy I'd been talking with turned to somebody else and said, here's your new salesman in South Carolina. And that's how I got into the golf business. And starting with Dunlop was more luck, because they were a full service, full line golf company and the leading tennis manufacturer in the world since the between Dunlop, they also own Schlesinger. So I got exposed to a variety of different markets, trying to learn a little bit, ended up as sales manager for the Western United States. So I got a little experience in sales management. Then I did a little bit of independent rep work, and after a while ended up with Etonic, which again was a major player at that line with a full line of high-end shoes and stylish apparel. And there I learned about the footwear industry and about dealing with overseas suppliers and some things about the fashion market and a little bit about licensing because we had all Palmer, the license for Arnold Palmer shoes, which we used as our store brand. At that time, there was pro only and there was retail. And next, I ended up with as VP of sales and marketing for the Kimberton Company, which was Pickering Active Sportswear. Most of the listeners won't remember the brand, but in the late 70s, 80s, and early 90s, we were the absolute dominant brand on the apparel side. We were the company that really started to focus on doing country club and event embroidery. If you wanted to buy a shirt at Augusta or Pebble or Mauna Kea or at a PGA Championship or a U.S. Open or a Masters, chances are you were going to be buying a Pickering. And that helped me get in front of the right people in the field, the high-profile golf professionals in the organizations. And that was quite educational. It opened doors, like with Golf Digest. They invited me to be a panelist for them selecting the top 100 and the best new golf courses, which again opened some more doors and was very lucky. So from there, I ended up with as VP of sales for Cobra, catching them at just the right time as they're getting ready to evolve into King Cobra, which became the best-selling iron in golf. And again, I got in front of the right people and was able to continue my work with the PGA and stayed on the Golf Manufacturers and Distributors Association. Also had, 40 years with the PGA on the National Awards Committee, still on it today. So you add all that together, a lot of luck.
Well, a lot of great influence on the market as well. I think when we first met was when you were with Cobra, and it goes without saying you've seen it all in your career within the industry. And I'm sure as you look out at the landscape of golf today, what in your mind has been the most significant and important changes in the business side of it? In particular, what's your take on where we are now versus where we were when you first got started?
Leaving the technology and the innovations for the next paragraph. The big changes have been, to me, the loss of the family companies. I mean, it used to be like the Wilson family-owned Wilson Beef Packing Pharmaceuticals and Wilson Golf. So they had meat balls, goop balls, and golf ball. But the Rickey family-owned McGregor, and it was a far smaller, obviously, industry, not what you would call corporations overseeing everything, and far more relationship-driven than it is today. And I think that may be the thing that I miss as much as anything. The other changes on the golf course side, and Joe Black and Robert Dedman started Club Corps, and that initiated the evolution of the golf management and ownership companies. I think Thune is one of the leaders today, and that's become a worldwide phenomenon. You've had the growth of the merchandising specialists and the emergence of the Association of Golf Merchandisers, which really has added a female component into the industry. But from the field standpoint, those are, and the blurring of the lines between off course and on course, there's no such thing as only anymore. And the emergence of the Oriental brands has been one of those changes. So those are most of the things that I see in the field, on the ground, that has really changed in the time I've been in the industry.
You know, Jim, innovation has always been a buzzword around the golf equipment industry. In fact, our research for years has helped unlock what that really means and how innovation continues to be the key motivator behind equipment sales. How can equipment manufacturers today unlock more innovation? And what does that mean for the marketing side of the business? How can the marketing side evolve, given the fact that golf-specific experience have become more widely defined to meet a broader audience?
I'll start with a bit of a historical perspective as that goes, because I've watched the industry change from artisan to digital. Embroidery changed from mechanical machines being run by tapes like player piano tapes that were created by artisans in Germany, to now everything's digitized in computer machines. Think about the golf club market, the evolution of investment cash coming out of the aerospace industry in Southern California. And you have people like Carson Stolheim and Carl Ross with Lynx getting into that business and became, you could literally start a golf club company in your garage. The difference in shafts today with autoclave technology for a lot of the graphite stuff, the launch monitors changing the way people evaluate their games and the way people teach the game. Those are some of the things that I've watched come along with the growth of alternatives like Topgolf and that type of thing. So you have that side of it. And as far as innovation going forward, it's twofold things. One, it's becoming more and more specialized. And number two, it's becoming more and more expensive. And I think if I had a worry about the technological side, remembering that what we're selling is hope, I would worry about how expensive hope is getting.
Interesting perspective on it. You know, again, we could talk about so much that you've seen and done. I want to try to wrap things up. Believe it or not, it feels like we just started chatting. But if you can reflect, you know, you always were very good, I remember, at kind of seeing the big picture and helping to see things forward. And I thank you for that, you know, given the years that we work closely together. What advice would you have for the industry as a whole over the next 10 years? In particular, what do we need to do better?
Other than the price situation, which, you know, affects both how much it costs to play and how much it costs to equip, I think that in our headlong rush to embrace diversity and attract more juniors and women and minorities into the game, that we shouldn't lose sight of the value of the core golfer. I think we need to continue to cater their needs as well, because keeping a player is a, once a player leaves, it's far more difficult to get him back than to get them into the game in the first place. I think that's the biggest thing that I see looking forward is concern about the pricing and concern about how we attract new players into the game. I mean, we're one of the few industries that can say that COVID was a contributing factor to our growth. It reinvigorated the industry in a lot of ways. And you being at the show, you saw the first year after the COVID experience was behind us, the explosion at the golf. And that continued this year, extremely active and very encouraging. But I think we need to be vigilant about the issues of price and how we maintain the growth factor. And then there's a lot of the little things, the short courses, the putting courses. If you have visited the new PGA home here in Frisco, Texas, you see that they're reaching out with a variety of landscapes for people to get introduced to the game of golf. It's really a neat experience.
Yeah, no, it seems like, you know, again, I'm at the point where I've seen the ways it was and the way it's heading, and there's a lot of exciting opportunity as well as certainly a need to not forget where we all came from and where the game kind of found its roots. And that's what makes it so exciting and interesting to still see someone like yourself involved. And I thank you for that. And I thank you for being on this episode of Drivers.
It was a treat.